Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And ooh, have we got a fun show today. It's all about pies, or maybe cupcakes. So wait, today it's fried chicken and macaroni and cheese. I mean, who would have ever thought that these familiar comfort foods of yesterday would become today's trends? Well, we're going to talk all about it, and you're going to hear the why and the what in just a couple of minutes. But first, I want to introduce you to a guest who's sitting with me, and she's sitting in to listen today. And her name is Sarah Kernan. She's a PhD candidate from Ohio. She's at the university, history department at Ohio State University. And it's interesting, I met her at a culinary historian event the other night, and she said she was excited. She said, I've used your show as references before for my studies or her classes that she teaches often.
Yes.
And her dissertation is on the production and use of cookery books in England and France from 1300 to 1600, exploring the mass communication shift from manuscript to print through the lens of cookbooks. Well, and we could even call that a trend. Look what's happened.
Yes, exactly.
Well, welcome, Sarah.
Thank
and
you.
I hope that Sarah's in New York for a couple of months because she has been awarded a special fellowship at the New York Public Library in food studies. And I hope you enjoy your time in New York, and I hope you enjoy our show today.
Thank you.
And I said we would talk about all of these food trends, and a very special guest to talk about it is David Sachs. David is a freelance writer specializing in business and food, and he's explored this topic in his entertaining new book, The Tastemakers: Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes, but Fed Up with Fondue. Welcome, David.
Good to be here.
David joined me a couple of years ago for his first book, which was Saving the Deli, the History of the Delicatessen. And I have to say that I haven't finished the book, but I am enjoying this book just as much as the deli book. It's a lot of fun, and you must have had a lot of fun writing it.
It was a very different sort of creature from the deli book, but very, very interesting. I sort of saw a side of the food world that I think a lot of people don't necessarily get to see, and I was very fortunate to have that opportunity.
Right. Well, now, David, we're talking to David. He lives in Toronto, but you did a lot of traveling around this part of the country as well to research this book. What is a food trend? I mean, how does a food trend differ from just a popular new product?
The definition is constantly moving, even in my own mind. But I have come to define it as a collective behavior of appetite, a society-wide craving for something. It could be something new that didn't exist, like the cronut that appeared last summer and all of a sudden everybody wanted to eat it. Or it could be this revised interest in things like mac and cheese or pies, which sort of sit dormant for a while and then all of a sudden have this cultural capital that gets attached to them and everybody wants it.
That's right. I mean, it's not exactly a new product, right?
Exactly.
Now you basically delineated four major types or different types of trends. Can you explain that for us?
Sure. It's a fairly flexible definition, and they do sort of bleed into each other in terms of categories. But there are I think the most obvious for your listeners and most people who are consider themselves into food are chef-driven health trends. Something that some chef in New York or Los Angeles or Toronto or London creates in their kitchen, and then that flavor combination, that dish, that idea, spreads out and you start seeing it in menus and other places where that chef has never been, and it sort of filters its way down to sort of supermarket food. You know, I thought about your son's restaurant, Fatty Q, and there's a restaurant here in Toronto that does, you know, Southeast Asian influenced barbecue. You know, that's a great definition of it. That is, you know, your son Zachary did, you know, created or this mashup style sort of southern barbecue with these Asian flavors, and it became popular and written about and sort of chronicled in a way that it sparked a trend, and you saw then chefs doing it in all these other cities that may not have even, you know, eaten at Fatty Q. There are agricultural trends which are very much on the opposite end of the spectrum. They're not sort of flash in the pan things created by, you know, this one individual. It's often a much longer, laborious process created with, you know, teams of people who are looking to revive a particular product or breed a new plant or a new strain of animal that then becomes itself popularized and can have a great impact not only in terms of dining but in terms of, you know, the way food is grown and cultivated and raised. There are health and diet trends which you know, are fairly ubiquitous, and it's everything from, you know, the so-called superfood craze around antioxidants and you know, different berries like the Brazilian acai berry or
kale,
all of a sudden really healthy, to diets like, you know, the gluten-free diet or the fat-free diet or the cholesterol-free diet, or, you know, those crazy, you know, South Beach diet. Those are, you know, a whole other sector of trends, and I think those are sort of the most powerful and somewhat dangerous ones. And then there's something that is the cultural trend, which is the best example is cupcakes. It takes something that already exists, a food that people know and are familiar with, and it changes it by injecting it with a different narrative, a different sort of story that all of a sudden makes that food something else. The cupcake went from being this children's birthday treat to this symbol of sort of feminine sexuality because it was associated with Sex in the City.
Right.
And on the back of that, it grew into this worldwide industry of cupcakeries, which continue to spread, even though it may not be popular in, you know, Soho and the West Village. There are new cupcake shops excitedly opening up in Sao Paulo and Pakistan and Rwanda, which is, you know, incredibly interesting, but just shows that when something is, when a trend has a cultural force behind it, it can really drive it into places that cupcakes never would have been or other food.
That's right. Well, you say that the cultural kind of reflects something that's going on in our society. Well, what about, would you lump in, you know, the new ethnic cuisines with this as well? I mean, as the world gets smaller and more people are traveling or immigrants introduce their food, certain ethnic cuisines over the years have become extremely trendy.
Yeah. That I find is actually a somewhat different process. I mean, I think they are cultural trends in their way, but they can be chef-driven. So if you, you know, if you think about the great sushi boom in North America in the 1980s and 90s, where sushi went from being this very rare, very refined, so rare it was raw, food that, you know, people had eaten in Japan, and, you know, maybe you would have with a Japanese businessman, there'd be one or two places in each city, and it was scary and expensive and amazing, to something that you can get in any supermarket now. You know, there were a number of factors that went into it. So, you know, there was that cultural reflection, which was, you know, Japanese business people, Japanese corporations in the 1980s really came to sort of dominate the conversation around consumer culture in North America. You know, the automobile industry, everybody all of a sudden was driving Toyotas and Hondas. Every kid had a Nintendo and, you know, lived by characters named Yoshi.
Mario.
as I did. You know, Japan was sort of this cultural force, and with that came food, came sushi. It became something that was cool. But it was also driven by chefs like Chef Morimoto in Los Angeles, who took that food and tweaked it, took something that was very traditional and tweaked it to make it into the North American market, blended it with other flavors, so globalized it in a way, and that evolved into California rolls and mango chicken rolls and things that have no relation to anything that's eaten in Japan, but it becomes something that's culturally acceptable, and so the food moves from that ethnic enclaves into the mainstream, and you're seeing that more and more these days. You see it with Southeast Asian foods, and just look at the popularity of Sriracha hot sauce, this Thai style hot sauce, which is now in Subway subs. Mm-hmm. And has really moved again from that niche to the mainstream. So as things are getting more globalized, that's happening a lot quicker.
That's right. The young woman who's sitting in with me listening to the show today, Sarah, we actually met at a culinary historian program on ramen. And, in part because ramen has taken off. It's a new craze. And who would have thought, this bowl of noodle soup, which took on a much different connotation from Japan even. And it became even a trend in Japan before it hit here, obviously. So do we kind of overdo things when something suddenly becomes the new kid on the block or the new trend? You think we just drive it into the ground? Is that what kills a trend?
I think it is. It is a question of overexposure. I mean, remember that as much as it's cultural and as much as we're talking about cooking at home, food is a business. It's one of the biggest, most powerful businesses that employs probably some of the majority of other industries in this country and in other countries as well, and trends represent dollars, dollars that have been gained and dollars that are out there to be gained. If you can do something popular, and you can sort of latch on to the trend bandwagon as it's moving, then far be it to sort of ignore that in the name of, culinary purity.
Right.
Which is why you get bacon in every sort of product once bacon becomes popular. And obviously it reaches a point where the market becomes oversaturated and there's this level of ridiculousness and it jumps the shark. But along the way, that is pushing people to innovate and do better things. So you think of the bacon trend, you think, oh God, it's just so overdone. There's bacon ice cream and, an entire menu of bacon stuff at Denny's and, bacon flavored lip gloss, enough with this. But that also had the effect of getting your average consumer to demand better quality bacon raised from better quality pigs. You can get apple wood smoked bacon at McDonald's now, which is something that you never would have had before. There's far more brands of niche bacon and boutique bacon out there that are growing faster and doing better. And so, as much as we say, oh gosh, not another cupcake shop, it represents a sort of a spirit and an economy of entrepreneurship. That has a tremendous benefit, I think, at the end of the day.
That's true. And that was
more beneficial than Silicon Valley.
Right. And that was something that was one of my points that I wanted to get at, that there are certainly trends aren't a bad thing. And you just mentioned a couple of the beneficial effects. Would you think that more beneficial effects are derived from the agricultural trends or it's a mixed bag?
It's a mixed bag. Look, there are agricultural trends that, GMOs are an agricultural trend within the agriculture business. A lot of people would argue that they're not beneficial and they're harmful.
Mm-hmm.
Various Monsanto crops. I don't think trends are good or bad in one way or another. They can be anything. I mean, there are massive supersized meals and burgers. That's a trend, and that is not beneficial to our waistlines and the collective health of our society. But the trend, the growing trend of eating organic and sort of humanely raised meat, which is now something that places like Chipotle and McDonald's are talking about, those are beneficial, and you can certainly see those benefits. I think where it's most beneficial and the fun kind of more fad-driven culture of food trends, we in sort of the food world talk about, is that the economic benefits and the cultural benefits of that entrepreneurship that it pushes. So you think about a pop-up market such as Smorgasburg in New York, or the various food truck lots and food truck scenes.
Food trucks in themselves.
All around North America. A lot of those people are sort of reaching for the next trend. And you get crazy things like ramen tacos and ramen burgers, which are definitely faddish. It's not like we're not going to all be eating ramen burgers in the next couple of years. They're link bait, food press bait. But what they do is they push people to try new businesses, to start new things, to invest, to create jobs, to sort of generate income and excitement and new business models that both benefit, themselves and the people who work for them and the greater society financially, but also culturally push us forward, push us to say, okay, well, everybody's doing Thai food. What can we do? What's going to be different? Why don't we try Malaysian food? Why don't we try, food from Goa? Why don't we start selling food from Paraguay? It pushes the bounds and it keeps our food culture from becoming static, which I think is something that we often take for granted.
Right. And the business aspect is something that I want to hold on to. We have to take a short break, but I want to come back to the business aspect of the food trends too. So hold on, and we'll be right back after a short break.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Hi, I'm talking with David Sachs, the author of The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. Poor fondue. It had its day. It was fun. But David,
it'll come back.
That's okay. All right. Everything old is new again. Right.
We'll have some really cold winter.
Okay. I wanted to come back to the business point. And that sort of answer asks the question, who starts a trend, or how do they get started? And the post-war industrial environment was a big one that started crazes. I guess you could call them crazes. Well, we didn't ask for them, but suddenly there they were, such as cake mixes, puddings, and jellos. That was sort of foisted upon us and became a craze, I guess, for a while.
The idea of I think technologies and again what people value it is certainly can drive trends. That post-war idea of convenience, science and chemistry coming to solve all our problems. Now we can be liberated from the kitchen. We don't have to pickle things and preserve and cure them. And you think about the difference between the 1950s kitchen and today, and it's incredible because we've tried to go back to that period.
Right.
And then I'm sure in a couple of years it'll swing in the other direction. It's like, okay, enough of the artisanal pickling already. just want a jar of pickles.
Well,
I don't want to have to wait 10 weeks for them.
Right. It's certain lifestyle movements, and I think of groups like the hippies, the yuppies, the hipsters. A lot of food trends are center around these lifestyle groups. Certainly some, and some that had benefits too, you know, the organic farming and all, you know, all these, eating healthfully and things like that. But food trends have existed way far back in history. What's one of some, an old example of a food trend, if you will, that you can cite?
Certainly. I mean, I think, you know, coffee is a great one. It's not something we need. It's not a staple that was sort of there for our survival. It's this, you know, indulgence in a way. That started off as this very isolated crop in Ethiopia, and then moved around the world and became this, you know, central thing to, you know, Turkish culture and European culture, Italian culture, and became a staple. And so you've seen the coffee trend really continually evolve in all sorts of different ways, and yet it's central. So we may brew it differently, we may consume it differently, it may take different forms in terms of different types of businesses, but you know, its roots go back a long, long way.
That's right.
And so I think the difference today is that, these food trends evolve much, much quicker. If coffee was discovered yesterday in Ethiopia, it wouldn't take, you know, 200 years for it to make its way to Vienna and Venice and then to, you know, another 500 to Starbucks. It would happen in the span of, you know, a year or less.
Right.
Because everything's so interconnected. We share our food culture now online and in media so much more easily and so much more widespread.
Right. And so, of course, we're seeing many more food trends today than ever before. But spreading is another point, how food trends spread. And actually, my guest has a question for you. Sarah?
Yeah, I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on how certain trends take off better than others. There are lots of little regional trends that never seem to make it nationally or internationally, while a lot of global trends seem to take off really well here, at least in the States. Why is there such a difference?
That's a really good question. You know, I think it is a multi-million-dollar question in terms of certainly the food business. They're always trying to figure out what is going to be the next thing to take off. What is the next trend that we can take and, you know, put into our McDonald's sandwiches, and will it work? Will people sort of buy into it? I think that the ones that generally succeed in taking off and becoming widespread long-term trends versus sort of regional fads or cultural fads that are more short-term are the ones that have the broadest possible appeal. You think about cupcakes and bacon, or bacon cupcakes, let's say. you know, as much as they've gone in all these sorts of crazy directions, fundamentally they're two trends that are built from culturally familiar things that most people can relate to. You can relate to cakes. You've had or smelled or know about bacon, and it's sort of been a part of your diet in some way or another, unless, you know, you don't eat it for religious reasons. And they're easy to get your hands on. You can get butter, eggs, sugar, flour, baking soda, and you know, make cupcakes. My wife made cupcakes for her daughter's first birthday the other day. It was fairly easy. Messy, but easy. And you know, bacon is readily available. Any chef can go out to the corner store, buy a thing of bacon, you know, cook it and crumble it up and put it in ice cream or in a cookie or you know, with Brussels sprouts or whatever. So when you think about some of the ones that haven't caught on, people are saying, you know, why hasn't kale sprouts caught on the way that Brussels sprouts or kale has? Well, kale sprouts is, you know, a relatively new vegetable that doesn't have a strong supply chain and a strong supply and doesn't, you know, ship very well. Food and Wine magazine I read a few weeks ago, it's in one of their online stories, that's saying, you know, uni is going to be the new bacon. Uni is the the flesh of sea urchin, that sort of orange, slimy, somewhat sweet creature of the sea that's eaten a lot in Japanese restaurants, and somewhat in Italian food, I think. That's going to be the new bacon. And I don't think they meant like you would eat it with eggs and pancakes, but that it would be, you know, it could go into any dish and we're going to crumble it onto anything. Well, that's never going to happen because, you know, unless people start cultivating huge aquaculture farms of sea urchin, and everybody's all of a sudden just going to flip switches in their mind and be like, yeah, this is definitely something that I'm going to eat. It's just going to appeal to sort of a small niche of knowledgeable eaters, and you know, your average person in a suburb in, you know, somewhere in the middle of the country is never going to have uni salad or uni ice cream, and has no desire to.
And conversely, I think that sometimes it's kind of sweet that some regional trends don't make it out of the region, because, you know, it's gotten to the point we're so homogenized. It's kind of nice to keep some of that regional difference, you know, as we travel across these huge great states and our northern neighbor,
yeah,
Canada, to see some different, you know, like, you know, poutine, how that hasn't become ubiquitous in every street corner in New York City, but yet, you know, you go to Canada and there it is all over the place, right? So,
yeah,
or at least certain parts.
Exactly.
It's nice to have regional differences, I think. In writing this book, as I say, you interviewed a lot of interesting people, especially in some of the chef-driven things, and also in about different trends, restaurateurs. And, of course, trends are not just unique to food. I mean, of course, there's fashion, there's art, there's music, there's, you know, but restaurants being a part of the food chain, restaurants are, you know, too, are trendy. In fact, we've even adopted the word in the gerund form and called it a verb, right? Things are trending. When did that start? You know, but that's very interesting. What was the most interesting or surprising point or interesting person that you interviewed or learned while researching this book?
I interviewed and briefly met a woman named Susie Badaracco, who lives in Portland, Oregon, and has a company called Culinary Tides, which essentially does food trend forecasting. And she's not, you know, going to the hottest restaurants in all the different cities and saying, hey, you know, this is what David Chang's cooking, and so, you know, you, Starbucks, should make it. She has a background in forensic criminology. She used to be the type of person who would sort of predict where a criminal was going to strike next for the Orange County Sheriff's Department. She trained in courses taught by the FBI and Scotland Yard and the Marine Corps, and then took that analytical mind and worked in the food industry for Nielsen and Nestle and big food corporations. And essentially what she does is mines data and tabulates all sorts of data points to build a map of where taste is moving, that she sells her clients, who are all the big food companies, whether it's, you know, restaurant chains or companies that are making different products that we buy in the supermarket. I went to one of her presentations, which she did at the Culinary Institute of America as part of this healthy food summit that, you know, everybody from McDonald's to the Mushroom Board to the Alaskan Seafood Council was there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just this crazy jumble of information and words and characteristics, and, you know, she refers to trends as orphans and stillbirths and, you know, and not yet conceived, and it was incredible to see, first of all, how incredibly smart this woman was, and how much data goes into the real science of food trend forecasting. This is not, you know, your food and wine or eaters, you know, top 15 food trends for 2015 to watch out for. This is deep Wall Street level analytics that is taking everything from immigration rates to economic statistics and job reports to the statistics of how many flights Americans are going on to X and Y destinations, and crunching that down into these are the flavors and foods that you might think about investing in and checking out on, because they're going to provide the greatest chance of a trend going mainstream, as Sarah was talking about.
All right, excellent.
And so yeah. she was just a very fascinating individual, and there's a lot of people like her, a number of them in the food industry, that work behind the scenes to really take data and translate them into companies who can then figure out which food trends are the ones that they should be capitalizing on.
All right, that's really excellent information. So it really takes a lot more than three movie stars sitting on a bench outside of a cupcake bakery to create a trend, right? Although it worked.
To bring it sort of to the mass market.
Right.
Again, I think these things, they still start with those innovators, a creative person, a chef, a cook, someone writing a cookbook, someone opening up a food truck that's just going to say, I'm gonna do Southeast Asian barbecue. Like that's cool. Those risk takers are still the ones at the forefront. But there's a lot of people between them and the customer at Walmart buying a tub of salted caramels.
Yeah.
And those are the ones who really take it, distill it down.
Great. Salted caramel. There you just
mass market.
Yeah, you just hit another one. Salted caramel. And before that, you hit on another one from long ago. It has a wonderful history. Ice cream. I mean, that was a great one too. All right. So here's the million-dollar question, David. What do you predict is going to be the next big food trend?
Well, first of all, don't take my word for it, because I'm not a forensic specialist. I looked at a number of them for this book, and I think there's a few that I certainly personally examined that I think have a good chance of becoming sort of bigger, better-known food trends. The one that I think strongest about is sort of mainstream Indian food in America. You see it more in Canada because we have more immigrants from India and Pakistan and South Asian countries. So here you can get a butter chicken sub at Quiznos. You can get a butter chicken poutine at poutine chains. You'll start seeing that, I think, in America more. There have been people who have tried to be doing this for decades, but I think now the combination of immigration patterns, of a sort of a second and third generation of American-born Indians and South Asians who are really prominent in the culture. Think about, the best-selling novels of Jhumpa Lahiri and, the top comedians are Aziz Ansari and Mindy Kaling.
Mm-hmm.
That will filter down until someone will open up, an Indian Chipotle and translate a very rich and varied and complex cuisine into something that Americans can eat in their front seat of their car.
Interesting.
And that'll open it up.
Right. The section you wrote about, in fact, you wrote about Indian cuisine and you wrote about Cafe Spice. I was really very intrigued with that because I had no idea that of its background and the starting of Cafe Spice, and how immigrant workers, well, that we know through history and how different cuisines are developed, and often it's through the workers, the immigrants who come and either cook their own food or cook it and serve it to other workers, and that's why I asked that question about ethnicity, ethnic foods, being lumped in with the cultural changes. And certainly it is. I mean, because workers come to fill a certain niche in a country and always bring their food with them, right?
For sure. I mean, think about, Chinese food, which is it's certainly a staple in my family. Good Jewish Sunday night dinners. that came with the people who were brought over to build the railroad. And they stayed and brought the cuisine with them and opened up restaurants and built this entire market for this cuisine, which is now fairly mainstream. I don't think there's too many people out there who've never eaten Chinese food in North America. I'd be shocked if it didn't be one.
I mean, if you say it, it's not a foreign. It doesn't sound like a foreign cuisine anymore. I mean, we've encompassed it into our whole culinary lexicon.
But it revives itself too, right? So our idea of Chinese food today is different from our idea of Chinese food in the 1950s, and it'll probably be different 20 years from now. We think we know it, and then we sort of go back and rediscover it and reinvent it, and it gets brought to the forefront. So now we're seeing this rise of sort of high-end Chinese or American Chinese, Mission Chinese food or Red Farm in New York City, which is, again, taking a traditional element and making it accessible to a different audience.
Well, I'm going to, first of all, let you know that my son is on to another wave, and he didn't create the trend, but once again, hitting on a new trend, and that's, locally sourced, farm to table. He's off on another trip there. But I'm going to throw something out that I'm going to predict. And I don't know if this is not really a food trend. I guess it is. I guess a certain flavor becomes trendy, right? Sumac. That's the next big food trend.
Well, okay. that's
everything's going to be flavored with sumac.
I could sum it up in one word, Ottolenghi.
There you go.
That's why I know I have it in my house. That sometime there's a cultural moment where sumac's been around. It's nothing new
in
the Bible. But there's a cultural trigger, and the success of that Jerusalem cookbook 2 years ago, I guess, was such a phenomenon that not only did it increase sales and interest and of sumac and za'atar and all these different ingredients and spices, pomegranates here. But you're now seeing all these nouveau Israeli restaurants opening up everywhere. Every single city has them. I mean, here in Toronto, there's like four hipster hummus places that have opened up in the past in the past 6 months. And so it's amazing. It's amazing to see that. And so you're seeing sumac. Now it is, in the cities and with people who read that cookbook and with sort of foodies, but you'll start seeing it go in all these different directions.
Yeah, my daughter-in-law harvests it upstate, and so yes, I know that this is going to be, if you can harvest it locally, and whoever thought you would want to, it's going to be a big thing, it's just too much to keep up with, but I'm so glad that you wrote the book.
Eating sumac Doritos. Right.
I'm so glad you wrote this book because it opens our minds to to thinking about what it is we're eating and where did this all start and how is this where is it going, and I just can't wait to see what you come up with next, David. It's great, and thank you so much for sharing your time with me and your knowledge about this wonderful topic of food trends. Everything old is new again, right? And thank you, Sarah, for sitting in.
Thank you.
It was my pleasure, Linda. Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening. You've been listening to A Taste of the Past, and I'm Linda Palacio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.